Well, good morning, everybody. Thanks again for singing with us. And my name is Dan. I'm honored to serve as pastor here and also to share with you the main message comes from the Bible. God revealed himself. He did so in the scriptures. And then we kind of get to know who he is, what he's done, and who he's made us to be. And I want to ask this question this morning, who am I? And what's my purpose? It's not just my question, it is the question. You may have noticed that the human identity crisis of who am I has started to create quite a bit of trouble in our culture. And in my opinion, we're kind of trapped between two opposing problems. And one is just the cliche stigmas, right? On the one hand, the idea that everyone is either a toxic man or a helpless woman. And there are two stereotypical categories, and there's no nuances. And then the other opposing problem, which is kind of the confusing mantra that no one fits any category, that there, in fact, human identity is fluid. There's no distinct categories, and anyone can be who or even what they decide or determine themselves to be. And the tensions, I'm assuming you've kind of sensed some of this, the tensions are rising around which of those is true and how culture defines identity. And the tension is not between opposing views in the culture, the tensions are the culture and how God defines identity. The Christians, of course, believe that God created human beings and has a lot to say about identity. So where do we start? Where should we start? I'm pretty amped up to show you this phrase that for a lot of you is going to be a reminder. You're going to say, oh, I recognize that. Oh, I used that this morning at breakfast. And it's this phrase, Imago Dei. Raise your hand if you use this phrase at breakfast this morning. Good for you. Amen. When you're teaching your children about why they exist. This is the phrase, Imago Dei. This is a massively important phrase for Christians who belong to God through their faith in Jesus. Imago Dei. Here's what it means. The image of God is in humanity. The image of God is in human beings. Every last one, every single human being. The Imago Dei. That means that human beings uniquely carry a distinct dignity, very distinct identity, and very distinct purpose that marks us, that makes us, that identifies us as image bearers of God himself. Image bearer, meaning I carry the image or the view of who God is, what he looks like, how he acts, how he functions. And there's a penetrating contrast for us, meaning the fundamental roots of our identity are clear to God. Here's one way to think of it. This is kind of like where we're headed in the next several weeks. I put it here for us to kind of like probably, hopefully, absorb this maybe a bit at a time. Our identity is rooted in our Creator rather than in our culture. This is uniquely Christian worldview. This is uniquely Christian fundamental conviction about where human beings came from and who we are. It's rooted in our Creator rather than our culture. Our fundamental identity isn't fluid or something we decide, but something God determines. So this here is, you may have noticed, this is an unpopular position to take in a culture that is has a uniquely non-Christian worldview, secular humanist worldview in some cases. So keep this in mind. Our identity is rooted in our Creator rather than culture. Culture's not defining our identity. The Creator is. And our fundamental identity isn't fluid or something we decide, but something God determines, right? Our fundamental identity is something determined by God, not something we decide. But what does God tell us about living by faith in Jesus and being a disciple? What does he say? Here's what he says. Reclaiming our identity in Jesus is central to gospel transformation. We talk a lot about gospel transformation around here, and central to that is reclaiming our identity. In fact, learning and growing in who we are as determined by our Creator, not by our culture. One of the most fundamental things that we are trying to accomplish as disciples is the discovery and development of our identity in relationship to God. It starts with this: in the beginning. In the beginning. If you go all the way back, Genesis is the book, right? The beginning. In the sixth day of creation, we see a shift to the pinnacle of God's creation, the grand finale. And God does his creative work, and eventually he gets to day six, and it's humankind, human beings. Unlike prior creations, there's a profound statement in the part where God is describing his own creation, right here in Genesis chapter 1. Check this out. So God created human beings in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. So here's an answer to a question that you might hear or you might perceive that's happening in the modern world that we live in. Let me run this one by you. Why can't Christians just accept? Why in the world can't they just accept that some people just don't fit in to the sex and gender binary? One or the other. Why can't Christians just lay off and accept it? What is wrong with them? In other words, what do they care? What in the world do Christians care if someone feels they're neither one or they're somewhere in between? Well, this is why. Because of chromosomes XX and XY that match biologically the description that God gives us in the beginning of what he created and who he created. So to the answer to the question that Christians give, and Christians' answers are not, the two-sex binary is not coming from rigid and uncaring, merciless Christians. If I may speak for every Christian on the planet, they are coming originally from this conviction that it was already revealed to us how God created and who he created and in what categories he created, and Christians latch onto this. Now, some Christians, as you know, use their convictions as a bludgeoning tool, right? We know that. The objective of some Christians is not to be persuasive with the truth, but to be right, to win the argument, to shut down the other side, or whatever their motive is. But this is the source of where a lot of Christians' convictions are coming from to answer that question. In other words, it's believed by people who belong to Jesus and know the creation story, it's believed that these binary, this male-female creation, is created by God and hardwired into creation by the Creator himself. Hardwired. And the term image, or imago, imago Dei, the image of God, it means something concrete. And it means this, that humans are created to mirror God's character and purpose. Now, a mirror is a reflection, right? So you could use that word, but I'm going to use it after this to be more specific. But this is what the Christian faith shows us, that humans are created, and they're created as worshipers who are created by an infinitely supreme God, and he has imprinted, he has kind of like they bear his image, they look like him. They become mirrors where if you see a human being, you can kind of get familiar with the way God is. And this answers the question, why do I exist? You exist. You exist to mirror who God is, to project, to radiate, to reflect. And you exist to mirror what God does, who he is and what he does. Therefore, we get to see what God looks like. in some ways. Not perfectly, obviously, inadequately and incompletely, but in some ways. So obviously we're not identical to God, but we carry aspects of his nature instinctively. We're uniquely able, unlike, and this is right in Genesis, unlike creatures and critters that scurry about, thank God, we are uniquely capable to mirror God's rationality, meaning human beings can reason and they have the ability to rationalize unlike creatures and critters. And we see that, right? If you're raising a toddler, you're like, stop with the rationalizing and trying to reason with me. I am the boss, and who taught you to reason and rationalize like that? They're unique creatures in their human capacity to do that. Also, we carry with us the ability for morality, an innate desire to do what's right. We have a desire and capacity to do what's right. That's the image of God that we carry with us. The creativity that we have, right? Your impulses to create and design and to work. Where are my creatives in the room? Raise your hand if someone's called you a creative before. Where are you? Thanks for being on time today, by the way. I'm just kidding. That's a terrible stereotype. You know that instinct to create? Imprinted, image of God, you're carrying it, the supreme creator in all of the universe who knit it all together and hung things in place and created the human body and all of the other fascinating, mind-blowing reality of the universe and everything in it is God's character imprinted. You're carrying his image. Imago Dei, you have that image in you to create. And also, another example of relational capacity. The reason that we need people, the reason that we love people, the reason that we want to be loved by people, the reason that we have a capacity to love, care, forgive, and reconcile is because it reflects God's image. It's who he is, and we carry that. So the value and purpose of human beings come from this God-given role. This God-given role. Our value and purpose come from reflecting and reigning. Reflecting and reigning. So since we're image bearers, what are we supposed to be doing? What are we supposed to be spending our lives doing? Well, reflecting and reigning. God literally says this. He says, then God said, this is in Genesis 1, let us make human beings in our image to be like us. Right, you can see God, he's in this perspective or voice. Let us create us human beings in our image to be like us. They will reign over the fish in the sea, the birds in the sky, the livestock, all the wild animals on the earth, and the small animals that scurry along the ground. Ew. So, we have been created to reflect, right? God says, we're going to make them to be like us. And human relationships are meant to reflect God's character, his glorious character of holiness and humility and harmony and truth and love and mercy, or the fruit of the Spirit is all a reflection of who God is, that he's given us the capacity to reflect. Now, what does this mean? That means that as we are image bearers in a fallen world, that we're relating to people who we don't like, or worse, we loathe. Right? When we're interacting with our perceived enemies or people that put us off, we recognize, because of this, we recognize that every single person, every race, rank, and religion carries the image of God and is deserving of respect and value and dignity as a fellow image bearer. That means that we fundamentally are compelled and called and expected to treat every other human being as image bearers with respect and compassion, right? So do we loathe what our worst enemy is doing? Yes. We loathe what our worst enemy is doing. Are we expected to respect them? We don't have to respect what they're doing, but as a human being image bearer, they are like us in that they have been created by God to be like God, And we have the responsibility of saying the very shred left that I'm able to respect is that they're a human being. And God created them. And he created them in his image. And they've taken a turn, and they've made these decisions, and they've become, they're doing all kinds of evil things that kind of hurt and injure and damage people in the world, but at the very least, every race, rank, and religion gets respect. So then, what are we supposed to be doing? A part of what we're supposed to be doing is to reign over or rule over the earth. What does that mean? That means that creation has been provided, and that creation points to God, but also we as human beings are not creation worshipers. Instead, we are creator worshipers, right? So we don't worship what came from the hand of the creator. We actually worship the creator himself. It also means that earth should be ruled and managed as a gift from God to us. We get to steward and manage the earth as if God has gifted to us in order to help us flourish. So what he created is for our use to flourish as a human being. It isn't the other way around. We don't exist to make sure that Peanut the squirrel flourishes. God rest his soul. If you're not up on that, you didn't miss anything. You did not miss anything. So here's what we learn. Male, this is right out of Genesis. This is God saying, here's my design. This is how I want you to view where we came from and what we're supposed to be doing. Male and female is different but equal. Different but equal. Same dignity. Men, women, same exact dignity, value, and worth. There's no difference. There is no distinction. Same capacity to reflect God's character. Same character, same capacity. But in our male and female unity, there is purposeful distinction. In the unity of men and women, there is purposeful distinction. What does that mean? Well, male and female are made to embody God's image differently, but equally. It comes from the men and women who are made to fit together to reflect God's nature more fully than either one can reflect alone. Together, there's a reflection of God's nature better and more fully and in more completeness than they are able to do it, reflect God's character alone. What does that mean? That it means that females need males to better reflect God's character, and males need females to better reflect God's character. It reminds me of this frustrating line that the coach of my favorite football team uses all the time, especially when they're losing consistently. And he says, well, we got to play complimentary football. And of course, when I first heard that, I said, that's the dumbest thing. That doesn't sound like football. What are you talking about? That's why you're losing. You don't know what you're doing. I sent an email. Please, I'm available every Sunday. Complimentary football. Here's what he means. It doesn't matter if our offense scores. Our defense has to stop the other team from scoring more. It doesn't matter if our defense stops the other team from scoring, our offense needs to score. And also, if both of them are doing that and our special teams can't kick or punt or cover the punt or in any ways do their job, it doesn't matter. In other words, every single part of our team has equal value and worth and has a role to play. And when they play their role all together, the Cowboys barely lose. Barely, only by a little. Complementary football. God has created a male and a female, physiologically, biologically different with different chromosomes, and they are identified together, and together they are better equipped with the capacity to reflect God's image, to live the imago Dei. No single part is more important than the other. So God created human beings in his own image. Male and female, he created them. He decided to do that. And the completeness of his image in humanity happens in the unity of diversity. The attributes, the unique and distinct attributes that males and females carry. Their unique and distinct relational dynamics and instincts, strengths and physiology. And if we embrace our identity, If we embrace our identity as male and female in God's image, it frees us to recognize and to honor the differences in sex and gender. It sets us free to recognize that and to honor that and those distinctions and to affirm that they have equal value, worth, and purpose in the design that God has intended. So, their different roles that are designed by God are displayed by fundamental differences, right? So you see two here, and there are fundamental differences that God has hardwired in to the lives. We'll call it biological hardwiring. And the fundamental differences in biological hardwiring are not designed to be expressed in household responsibilities, right? By saying this, we don't mean that women, we're not saying that women, or we should say it this way, women are not hardwired by God, so they alone can do the dishes and vacuum and cook every meal. That's not a physiological hardwiring created by God. And you can imagine that in some cases it goes all the way to these roles and responsibilities being confused with hardwiring, and then you've got yourself a real crisis. And we see that crisis happening in our homes and hallways all the time. But instead, women are hardwired biologically to conceive, carry, and feed an unborn child in her body, unlike the man who isn't hardwired to do that, right? And both can reflect God's character by loving that child, by protecting that child, by providing for that child. And men, males, are hardwired with testosterone, and they're hardwired with muscle mass to use their strength to build a home from the forest, to pull down trees, to fight bears with their bare hands, to snatch fish out of the streams. I'm losing my way here. But men have a unique strength, and we'll just picture this, building out in the forest, building shelter, using their strength, and also the ability with that strength to protect their home and family from malicious and evil enemies. Unless you live in my house where when the enemy approaches, I say, honey, go see what that is. Go just, you have really good instincts. You have really, really good intuitive. Let me know if you need me. Just want to be complimentary. The Journal for Adolescent Health, this is one of many, many studies, discovers that biologically, at the end of puberty, males have 150% of the lean body mass of an average female. And 2 times more muscle cells in their physiological body. It's the conviction from the Christian faith that that's not accidental or incidental, that's not cultural or imagined, that's not fluid or socially constructed, that that's a hardwiring that God has developed in order to provide a way for men and women to live distinctly with equal value but different roles. Of course, there are dozens and dozens of roles that are confused, that culture over time has changed and has demanded, and it's worth sorting out what exactly, how fundamental does that mean, and we'll take time to do some of that over the next several weeks. Now, we know this. Can females protect themselves versus men? Of course they can. Yes. But males are given that hormone called testosterone, which is high levels of aggression, risk-taking, as I said, muscle mass, to do it naturally versus other men, to do it naturally. That a collection of men with the ability to protect families and neighborhoods and is in large part something that men are hardwired to do. So our Imago Dei gives each human an unchangeable dignity which is not earned or chosen, but granted by God. A dignity, right? What does that mean? Well, think of it this way. The human dignity is unchangeable. That means specifically that if somebody that you know and love has a physical disability, a mental illness, gender dysphoria, social economic depression, if they have a sentence, they're on death row, they've been sentenced to die, or if they're an unborn child still in the womb, dignity of that human, no matter where they are, if they're any one of those, is the same. Oh, and imagine, it's the same as the royals that we see broadcast from Britain. Right? It's the same. Those royals don't have more dignity than someone on death row. Why is that true? Because God created that to be true. God intended for that to be true. If you have a loved one that is laying there at the end stage of their life and they have not passed on from this life to the next, and they lay there and people would say, oh, they're useless. No, it doesn't matter if they're useless or useful. They have in their DNA hardwiring human dignity because they exist. And they have the breath of God that is animating their body. Human dignity. No matter what someone has done, no matter how far someone has fallen, no matter how sick someone's got, or no matter how their body is malfunctioning, or no matter what evil they have committed, human dignity doesn't change. It's unchangeable. Pastor, that's your opinion. It is. I'm trying to explain. It's so freeing to say, it's not my opinion. This is the best we can do to interpret that this is God's opinion, that human beings carry with them no less dignity if you're one of those or if you're the emperor of an entire hemisphere. That the Imago Dei, fundamentally, there's human dignity and identity that can't be earned. There is a dignity that humans carry that can't be lost. And there's a dignity that can't be chosen or circumstantially achieved. And this truth really does correct and it contrasts secular humanist worldviews. What does secular humanist mean? It basically means that God is irrelevant to human flourishing. That God doesn't contribute to human flourishing. That humans are on their own to flourish with their own resources and in their own means. But this is corrected. This narrative that we get out of the book of Genesis is corrective, because the secular humanist worldviews base value and worth on evolving feelings or evolving life circumstances. And that's why so many people, I think, express this phrase here, I'm so confused about who I am. I'm so confused about why I feel worthless. It's because of a steady message that we're getting, and that you start to hear that really all children are informed by our culture to self-create and self-discover. Self-create and self-discover, right? You determine your dignity, value, and worth. It doesn't come from a creator. You get to decide where your dignity, value, and worth comes from. In other words, the best thing you can do as a child is to come fully alive, is to break free from the expectations of your oppressive family and culture and your religion. So, modern American culture is sending different signals. And here's some of them. I want to give you just a really quick rundown on the five main identity messages. You could simply see them in five A's of secular humanism, right? This would be someone who isn't necessarily atheist, but somebody who doesn't believe that there is a divine being that's relevant in any way for human flourishing, that you are on your own, you can be about yourself, and you can certainly do it with your own godless philosophy. And it goes like this. Actualization, that's one. What is this message? Well, this is self-discovery and self-expression is the highest form of existence. In other words, be true to yourself. Find your true self. And then this idea, this philosophy encourages individuals to look inward to discover their identity. And you emphasize personal desires and feelings and uniqueness, and this will tell you who you are, but you're not fully alive and you are not fully fulfilled until you're expressing the self that you discover inside. Secondly, autonomy. This means, this is an identity message that says you are unrestrained in your personal freedom. You have no restraints in your personal freedom. You decide who you want to be, and your choices will define you. So choose wisely. And it goes on to explain that identity is something that you create. You don't inherit it. It's not something that you receive. And it promotes the idea that freedom comes from defining yourself without any external limitations that come from society, that come from your family, that come from your faith or traditional beliefs. Then we have achievement, which is you are what you achieve. You are the success that you have accomplished. Success measures your value. Your success measures your worth. You are what you achieve. Your success defines you. This idea is closely tied to accomplishing academic success, career progress, material wealth, social status, and this is why people who don't have those things would feel worthless, because I don't have achievements and successes like everyone else I know. Well, the main philosophy driving that is achievement, that people often feel the need to define themselves through performing. Then we have appearance, right? You are what you look like. You're as valuable as the level of attractiveness that you present. How you present yourself defines who you are. This approach emphasizes, obviously, physical appearance, obviously, style, current in our modern day now, maybe your presence on social media, and all of these are the main key aspects of your identity formation. And then lastly, affiliations, relatively new to our culture here, the idea that you have a collective identity that you can't escape, and it's who you're affiliated with, and that your group affiliations inescapably shape who you are. And those that identity is defined in terms of social categories like race and gender, sexual orientation, socioeconomic class. And this concept called intersectionality highlights how these factors alone intersect to shape your individual experiences, whether you know it or not. You are who you're affiliated with. So these messages highlight some of the conflict and the chaos and the confusion that are swirling in our homes, in our churches, out in the marketplace, out in the modern life that you and I live. And these messages highlight the tension that's happening in the American culture. Discovering identity within oneself and the pressure to define oneself in specific, sometimes external ways. So, in practice, this means people often experience identity as flexible and fragile. Sometimes I feel like I'm somebody, sometimes I don't. I can't help but say that without thinking. Sometimes I don't. That is so depressing that that's down in there, just comes out. Almond Joy. 100 times out of 100. So, one of my favorite animated films. Let me say this again. I have many films like this. Favorite animated film with a message I despise. Classic, right? Love the film, main message. Oof. And I'm going to get personal with you a little bit here. I don't know why I ask you that. I'm going to get personal here a little bit, okay? I'm going to get a little bit personal. So if I start to get riled up, I'm not preaching, this is personal to me. Great movie. Love this movie. Watched this movie. Was thrilled at how entertaining this movie was. And I don't know if it sunk in while I was watching the movie or after the movie was over, but I started to think about this main messaging in this movie, and my blood pressure starts. I mean, I am like, wait a second. What did we just sit there and watch? The daughter of the dad, who's a strong character in the film, wanders away from the family and meets a random wild child boyfriend. And he helps stir her desire to live fearless and free. But there's a problem. You know what the problem is? She's got a dad who's afraid. He's traditional. He is... The family, her family and her father are holding her back. So, the solution for this daughter is a random unemployed gypsy child. And he now kind of like scoops her up with no family of his own, and he's going to rescue her from the oppression of her father and her family. And when I was watching this, I missed it. And I'm praying that, hopefully kids miss that. But this this random unemployed gypsy boy is saving her from the oppression of the father's fears and his outdated family roles and what he wants for his family and tradition. Of course, there's people who have these abusive roles and traditions that are not healthy for human flourishing. But in this particular case, it was him who led her out of the care of her dad in order to discover her purpose and value. And I thought to myself, this isn't just in this movie. This is like almost every animated movie for kids I ever watch is essentially about you need to be set free from the family and the traditional values that you care about, and you need to stop letting them define. You need to go out there and define yourself. So if you like the Croods, so do I. If you disagree with the message, I feel you. If you don't disagree with the message, that's okay. I think people interpret these things differently, but I loathe that kid. My worst nightmare happening right on the screen. So it's just personal, but I can feel that identity clash right there. So what do we do now? Let me ask you this. Here's what I want to ask you to consider. For a lot of you, this isn't going to be a challenge. But for some of you, this is going to be a challenge. For some of you, this isn't going to be difficult at all. You're already there. But then there's others. Maybe you're tuned in online. Maybe you're here among us, and maybe you're visiting the church, or you're new to the Christian faith or whatever. Here's what I want to ask you to consider. I want to ask you to consider replacing any confusion that you have with conformity. Ugh, conformity. Ugh. Now, if that word doesn't make modern people cringe, nothing does. And here's what I mean. Check this out. This is what the psalmist says when he's praying to God and he starts to get a feel for who God is. Look what he says. What are mere mortals? What are human beings? That you, God in heaven, the creator of the universe, should think about them at all, that they should ever, ever, ever be on your mind for a second. Human beings, that you should even care for them, right? It's one thing that they're on your mind, but who are we as mere mortals that you would go so far as to not just think of them, but also to care for them? In other words, we recognize as human beings, at the same time, we have this humble position in creation and the profound dignity that God gives us to know us, to be known by us as his image bearers. Can you see the tension? We are humbly unworthy. We are infinitely unworthy. But at the same time, he gives this spectacular joy of bearing his image. And here's the psalmist. Who in the world are we? And I want to challenge you with this. Just imagine, if you're not necessarily a Christian, I want to challenge you with this worldview. If you were created by the Creator, in fact, you know what Paul says? Paul the Apostle writes it this way. He says, imagine a lump of clay gets put on the potter's wheel and the potter starts to shape that lump of clay, and then the lump of clay says, whoa, 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 hold on. What are you making? Paul says, the clay doesn't say to the potter, oh, shape me like this and shape me like that. The potter shapes the clay however the potter decides, because on a whim, the potter can absolutely erase that clump of clay in a split second. And this is what I'm asking you to consider, that our identity formation, when it comes from the creator of the universe, it requires us some conformity to say, this really isn't about what I want and what I desire. This is instead about me conforming to a creator, and that I can't dictate or determine my personality. Why would I go on telling myself I need to create or prove my identity? Let me say that again. I can't determine or dictate my own personality. Why would I look at the creator of the universe and say, well, I don't care who you made me to be and what my purpose is. I myself am going to prove it. I'm going to create it. I'm going to determine it myself. Secondly, lastly, also I want to invite you to accept your new identity. Your new identity that is gifted and secured by Jesus. So this is massively formational and important for teenagers, for young adults, and even for some stressed out adults. Because this truth will change your life if you let it. Here's the truth. The gospel of Jesus is not about choosing or constructing an identity, but receiving an identity that's given as a gift. One of the joys of belonging to Jesus is you get to receive an identity. You don't have to work for it, and you don't have to earn it. You don't have to do any of the five A's and hopefully maintain it all. And it's fragile and flexible, and it's always changing, and you never know who you are or what you're worth. But when you belong to Jesus, you have a gift of identity. And that identity is remade and restored. Your identity, when you belong to Jesus, is remade and restored. When a human heart is remade and restored by God, it then belongs to Jesus in order to become like Jesus. When you put your trust in Jesus and you are joined to him and you are in union with Jesus, you say, well, that's a miracle that I belong to Jesus. It is, but you belong to Jesus in order to become like Jesus. He gives you the human capacity now to become like himself, which means your broken identity is restored when you belong to Jesus. You now have the capacity to become like Jesus. Well, why is that important? Here's why this is important. When you trust Jesus, you're no longer defined by your achievements or your failures. When you trust Jesus, you're no longer defined by your society's labels, but instead by being fully known and fully loved by God. Imagine he fully knows you and he fully loves you anyway. This heart level reorientation, when our heart is remade, called regeneration, it frees us to live humbly, but also confidently. Since our worth is no longer dependent on what we do, but instead it's on who we are in Jesus, who he has made us to be. So, Christ, Jesus, Colossians 1, is the visible image of the invisible God. So Jesus perfectly reflects God's image. And as we are united with Jesus, we are being conformed to his likeness. The reason why we can bear his image more and better when we belong to Jesus is because Jesus is the invisible image of God himself. He's the visible image of God himself, who's invisible. So through Jesus, our image capacity, our ability to bear the image of God is increased, is dramatically healed. It's remade and also restored. What does this mean? This means that anyone who belongs to Jesus has become a new person, and the old life is gone and a new life has begun. So Jesus doesn't merely just erase sins. Nope, it all is forgotten. I've expunged your past and all of the failures and flaws. But instead, he goes on, and he doesn't just erase that and expunge those things. He restores us to original design and purpose that God intended. So our human identity is not fragile. It's not fleeting. It's not dependent upon human effort, our wins and losses, our good hair days and our bad hair days. It's not based on whether we've lashed out at our kids or whether we are the gentle nurturer that we've always envisioned that we could be. It's anchored in the permanence of God's promises, of Jesus' sacrificial love to demonstrate his love for us and say, you belong to me. And when you belong to Jesus, it's for the purpose of becoming like Jesus. Remakes our identity, restores our identity, and gives us the capacity to live in the fruit of the Spirit, to look like Jesus, reflect and contrast just like Jesus.